Side 11. The Shining Ones. The Tomilly, Book 2. By David Eddings. Continuing on page 377. Chapter 25.
No, Calidore, Sparhawk said. As a matter of fact, it won't take 3 or 4 weeks. I have access to a faster way to get from place to place.
That won't do any good, Sparhawk, the ruddy-faced Camorrian objected. The people in the secret government won't take orders from you.
I won't be giving the orders, Calidore, Sparhawk told him. You will.
Calidore swallowed. Are you sure it's safe to travel that way? He asked dubiously.
Trust me. How many people will we have to get word to?
Calidore threw an uncomfortable glance at Sarabian. I'm not at liberty to say. I won't use the information, Calidore, the Emperor assured him. You and I know that, Your Majesty, but rules are rules. We like to keep our numbers just a little vague.
Generalize, Calidore, Elana suggested. 100? 500?
Not hardly that many, Dorlan, he laughed. There ain't no pie what can be cut into that many pieces.
He squinted a bit anxiously at Stragan.
Let's just say more than 20 and less than 100, and let it go at that, shall we? I'd rather not get my own throat cut. That's general enough, Stragan laughed. I won't turn you in for that, Calidore.
Thanks.
Don't mention it. 2 or 3 days, then, Sparhawk said. Let's not start passing the word around until after the NRA pulls her net through Krieger's mind tomorrow morning, Stragan said.
Thou art fond of that particular metaphor, my lord Stragan,
Zanisha noted, in a slightly disapproving tone.
I'm not trying to be offensive, NRA. I'm groping for a way to explain something I couldn't begin to understand, that's all.
Stragan's face grew bleak.
If Krieger really knows about the secret government, he's probably infiltrated it, and there'll be some people out there we won't want to tell about this.
And whose names we'll be adding to our list, Calidore added.
Just how long is your list, Master Calidore? Oscania asked.
You don't really need to know that, Your Excellency, Calidore replied, in a tone that clearly said he wasn't going to discuss the matter. Let's pick a date, something that sort of stands out in people's minds. Thieves and cutthroats aren't all that good at reading calendars.
How about the Harvest Festival? Itania suggested. It's only 3 weeks away, and it's celebrated in all of Tomilly.
Calidore looked around.
Can we wait that long? He asked. It would be the perfect time. Our murderers would have 3 nights to get the job done instead of 1, and there's lots of noise and confusion during the Harvest Festival.
And lots of drinking, Itania added. The whole continent gets roaring drunk.
It's a general holiday, then? Bevier asked.
Itania nodded.
Technically, it's a religious holiday. We're supposed to thank the gods for a bountiful harvest. Most people can get that out of the way in about a half a minute, and that leaves them 3 days and nights to get into trouble. The harvest crews are all paid off, they take their annual baths, and then head for the nearest town in search of mischief.
It's made to order for our purposes, Calidore added.
Will you be ready to move your forces against the trolls in 3 weeks, Lord Vanyan? Sarabian asked.
More than ready, Your Majesty. We weren't planning to gather them all in one place anyway. The detachments from each garrison are only platoon-sized, and a platoon can move faster than a battalion. They're all moving toward staging areas along the Aton border. Do we want to hit them all at the same time? Calton asked. We could go any one of 3 ways on that, Sparhawk said. We can hit the trolls first and pull Zalasta's attention to Northern Aton, or we can murder the conspirators first and send him scurrying around the continent trying to salvage what he can of his organization. Or we can do it simultaneously and see if he can be in 100 places all at the same time.
We can decide that later, Sarabian said. Let's get word to the murderers first. We know that we want them to go to work during the Harvest Festival. The military situation's more fluid.
Let's make a special point of eliminating Saber, Parok, and Rebal this time, Stragan said to Calidore. Evidently the Aetons missed them in the last general roundup. Those Aline kingdoms in western Tamale are standing between Sir Tinian and Mithurian. And as long as those three troublemakers are alive, he's going to have rough going. Is there any way we could get Scarpa as well?
Calidor shook his head. He's holed up in Natayos. He's turned it into a fortress and filled it with fanatics. I couldn't pay a murderer enough to try to kill him. The only way we'll get Scarpa is to mount a military expedition.
That's a shame, Sophronia murmured. The death of his only son would definitely twist a knife in Zelasta's belly.
Savage, Vanyan accused affectionately.
Zelasta killed my family, Vanyan, she replied. All I want to do is return the favor.
That sounds fair to me, he smiled. I'm still dead set against it, Stragan said stubbornly when he, Sparhawk, and Ulaf met in the hallway a bit later. Be reasonable, Stragan, Ulaf said. It won't hurt anything to see what they have to say, will it? I'm not going to just turn them loose without any restrictions at all, you know. They'll agree to anything to get their freedom, Ulaf. They might promise to pull the trolls out of Aton, or even to help us deal with Zelasta and Sirgon, but once they get back to Thalesia, they won't feel obligated to honor any commitments. We're not even members of the same species as their worshippers. We're just animals in their eyes. Would you feel obliged to keep promises you made to a bear? That would depend on the bear, I suppose.
The troll gods might break promises they make to us, Sparhawk said, but they won't break faith with Belium, because Belium can reabsorb them if they try any tricks.
Well, Stragan said dubiously, I want to be sure everybody understands that I don't like this, but I guess it won't hurt to hear what they have to say. I want to be present, though. I don't altogether trust you, Ulaf, so I want to hear the promises you give them. Do you understand, Trollish? Stragan shuddered. Of course not. You're going to have a little difficulty following the conversation, then, don't you think? Sophronia's going along, isn't she? She can translate for me. Are you sure you trust her? That's a contemptible thing to say. I thought I'd ask. When do you want to do this, Sparhawk? Let's not be premature, Sparhawk decided. I still have to take Calidor around to talk with his friends. Let's get that set up and make sure that the Aetons Vanyan's calling in are in the staging areas before we broach the subject of the troll gods. There's no point in getting them excited until we need them.
I think we'll want to be out in the countryside when we talk with them, Ulaf suggested. When we tell them that Sirgon's stolen their worshippers, their screams of outrage might shatter all the seashells off the walls of Mithurian.
His mind is much fogged by drink,
Zanisha reported about mid-morning the next day, after she and Barret had returned from the Senescan embassy.
And it is difficult to wring consistency from it.
Does he have any suspicions at all, Anaray?
Stragan asked with a worried expression.
He doth know that thou hast set thieves and beggars to watch him in the past, my lord Stragan, she replied. But it is his thought that thou, or young Talon, must make these arrangements in each city, and that one of you must go there to speak with each chief separately.
He don't know nothing about the secret government,
Calidor pressed, speaking in dialect for some obscure reason.
His understanding of thy society is vague, Master Calidor. Cooperation of such nature is beyond his grasp, for Craigor himself is incapable of it, being guided only by immediate self-interest.
What a splendid drunkard, Stragan exulted. Let's all pray that he never sobers up.
Amen, Calidor agreed fervently. Well, Sporehawk, why don't you have a talk with this year Juliorn, and me and you'll go a-hippity-skippin' round about Tomalee. We got us folks to see and thoats to cut. Zanisha's face took on a pained expression. Kaalador was badly shaken the first few times Belium whisked him halfway across the continent, but after that he seemed to grow numb. It took him about a half hour each time to pass instructions to the various criminal chiefs of Tamale, and Sparhawk strongly suspected that the ruddy-faced Camorian settled his shaken nerves with strong drink at each stop. Sparhawk could not be sure, of course, since he was quite firmly excluded from the discussions. "You don't need to know who these people are, Sparhawk," Kaalador said, "and your presence would just make them nervous." Venian's small Aton detachments were streaming into the staging areas along the Aton border from all over Tamale, and Takumi had promised several thousand Eastern Piloi, in addition to the 300 bowmen Kring had taken with him back to Aetana. Belium took Sparhawk and Venian to the Aton capital, so that they could reassure Betwana that they were, in fact, marshaling forces to come to her aid, and to explain why they were holding most of that aid at the border.
"The trolls wouldn't understand the significance of those reinforcements, Betwana Queen," Venian told her, "but Sirgon's completely versed in strategy and tactics. He'd understand what was going on immediately. Let's not give him any hints about what we're doing until we're ready to strike."
"Do you really think you can spring surprises on a god, Venian Preceptor?" she asked.
Betwana was dressed in what passed for armor among the Aetons, and her face clearly showed that she had been functioning on short sleep for weeks.
"I'm certainly going to try, Betwana Queen," Venian replied with a brief smile. "I think it's fairly safe to say that Sirgon hasn't had a new thought in the last 20,000 years. Military thinking's changed a great deal in that time, so he probably won't fully understand what we're up to."
He made a wry face.
"At least that's what I'm hoping," he added.
And then it reached the point where they could not put it off any longer. None of them were really comfortable with the idea of chatting with the troll gods, but the time had come to put Ulath's notion to the test. About an hour before dawn of the day none of them had really been looking forward to, Sparhawk and Venian went to Sophrenia's room to speak with Sophrenia, Zanisha, and Danae. Their discussions struck a snag almost immediately.
"I have to go along, Sparhawk," Danae insisted.
"That's out of the question," he told her. "Ulath and Stragan are going to be there. We can't let them find out who you really are."
"They're not going to find anything out, Father," she said with exaggerated patience. "It won't be Danae who will be going along."
"Oh, that's different then. Exactly how are we going to work this, Sparhawk?" Venian asked. "Won't you have to release the troll gods in order to talk with them?"
Sparhawk shook his head.
"Belium says we won't. The troll gods themselves will still be locked up inside Belium. Their spirits have always been free to roam around, except when Belium's encased in gold or steel. They have a certain limited amount of power in that condition, I guess, but their real power is locked up with them inside the Belium.
Wouldn't it be safer to get them to agree to use that limited power rather than to unleash them entirely?" Venian asked.
"It wouldn't work, dear one," Sophrenia told him. "The troll gods may encounter Sirgon, and if they do, they'll need their full power. Moreover," Zanisha added, "I do strongly believe that they will sense our need and bargain stringently."
"Are you going to do the talking, Sparhawk?" Venian asked.
Sparhawk shook his head.
"Ulath knows trolls, and the troll gods, better than I do. And his trollish is better than mine. I'll hold Belium and call the troll gods out, and then let him do the talking."
He looked out the window.
"It's almost dawn," he said. "We'd better get started. Ulath and Stragan are going to meet us down in the courtyard."
"Turn your backs," Danae told them.
"What?" her father asked.
"Turn around, Sparhawk. You don't have to watch this." "It's one of her quirks," Sophrenia explained. "She doesn't want anybody to know what she really looks like."
"I already know what flute looks like."
"There's a transition, Sparhawk. She doesn't go directly from Danae to flute. She passes through her real person on the way from one little girl to the other."
Sparhawk sighed.
How many of her are there?
Thousands, I'd imagine.
That's depressing. I've got a daughter I don't really know.
Don't be silly,
Danae said.
Of course you know me.
But only one of you. A several thousandth part of who you really are. Such a tiny part.
He sighed again and turned his back.
It's not a tiny part, Father.
Danae's voice changed as she spoke, becoming richer, more vibrant. It was no longer a child's voice, but a woman's. There was a mirror on the far side of the room, a flat sheet of polished brass. Sparhawk glanced at it and saw the wavering reflection of a figure standing behind him. He quickly averted his eyes.
Go ahead and look, Sparhawk. It's not a very good mirror, so you won't see all that much.
He raised his eyes and stared at the gleaming brass. The reflection was distorted. About all he could really see was the general size and shape. Afriel was somewhat taller than Sophronia. Her hair was long and very dark, and her skin was pale. Her face was hardly more than a blur in that imperfect reflection, but he could see her eyes quite clearly for some reason. There was an ageless wisdom in those eyes, and a kind of eternal joy and love.
I wouldn't do this for just anybody, Sparhawk, the woman's voice told him, but you're the best father I've ever had, so I'm stretching the rules for you.
Don't you wear any clothes? He asked her.
What on earth for? I don't get cold, you know.
I'm talking about modesty, Afriel. I am your father, after all, and things like that are supposed to concern me.
She laughed and reached around from behind him to caress his face. It was not a little girl's hand that touched his cheek.
He caught the faint scent of crushed grass,
but the rest of the familiar fragrance that lingered about both Danae and Flute had been subtly changed. The person standing behind him was definitely not a little girl.
Is this the way you appear to the rest of your family? He asked her.
Not very often. I prefer to have them think of me as a child. I can get my own way a lot easier in that form. And I get a lot more kisses.
Getting your own way is very important to you, isn't it, Afriel?
Of course. It's important to all of us, isn't it? I'm just better at it than most.
She laughed, a deep, rich laugh.
I'm probably the best there is at getting my own way.
I've noticed that, he said dryly.
Well, she said then, I'd love to talk more with you about it. But I suppose we shouldn't keep Ulath and Stragan waiting.
The reflection wavered and began to shrink, sliding back into childhood.
All right, then, Flute's familiar voice said. Let's go have it out with the troll gods.
It was blustery that morning, and dirty gray clouds scudded in off the Tommel Sea. There were few citizens abroad in fire-domed Mithurin as Sparhawk and his friends rode out of the palace compound and down the long, wide street leading to the west gate. They left the city and rode up the hill to the place from which they had first glimpsed the gleaming city.
How do you plan to approach them?
Stragan asked Ulath as they crested the hill.
Carefully, Ulath grunted. I'd rather not get eaten. I've talked with them before, so they probably remember me, and the fact that Sparhawk's holding Belium in his fist may help to curb their urge to devour me right on the spot.
Any particular sort of place you'd like?
Vanyan asked him.
An open field, but not too open. I want trees nearby, so I can climb one in case things turn ugly.
Ulath looked around at the rest of them.
One word of caution, he added. Don't any of you stand between me and the nearest tree once I get started.
Over there?
Sparhawk suggested, pointing toward a pasture backed by a pine grove. Ulath squinted.
It's not perfect, but no place really would be. Let's get this over with. My nerves are strung a little tight this morning for some reason.
They rode out into the pasture and dismounted.
Is there anything anyone would like to tell me before we start? Sparhawk asked.
You're on your own, Sparhawk, Flute replied. It's all up to you and Ulath. We're just here to observe.
Thanks, he said dryly.
She curtsied.
Don't mention it.
Sparhawk took the box out from inside his tunic and touched his ring to it. "Open," he told it. The lid popped up.
"Blue Rose," Sparhawk said, speaking in Alenic.
"I hear thee, Annika,"
the voice came from Vanyan's lips again.
"I feel the troll gods within thee. Can they understand my words when I speak in this tongue?"
"Nay, Annika."
"Good. Sirgon hath by deceit and subterfuge lured the trolls here to Deresia, and doth hurl them against our allies, the Aetons. We would attempt to persuade the troll gods to reassert their authority over their creatures. Thinkest thou that they might be willing to give hearing to our request?"
"Any god listens most attentively to words concerning his worshippers, Annika."
"I had thought such might be the case. Dost thou agree with mine assessment that the knowledge that Sirgon hath stolen their trolls will enrage them?"
"They will be discomfited out of all measure, Annika."
"How thinkest thou we might best proceed with them?"
"Advise them in simple words of what hath come to pass. Speak not too quickly, nor with obscured meaning, for they are slow of understanding."
"I have perceived as much in past dealings with them."
"Wilt thou speak with them? I say this not in criticism, but thy trollish is rude and uncouth."
"Did you put that in, Vanyan?" Sparhawk accused.
Vanyan blinked, his face changing subtly as Belium withdrew its hold.
"Not me," Vanyan protested his innocence. "I wouldn't know good trollish from bad."
"Forgive mine ineptitude, Blue Rose. Mine instructor was in haste when she schooled my tongue in the language of the man-beasts."
"Sparhawk," Sophronia objected.
"Well, weren't you?"
He addressed the stone again.
"My comrade Sir Uloth hath greater familiarity with trolls and their speech than do I. It is he who will advise the troll gods that Sirgon hath stolen their creatures."
"I will bring forth their spirits, that thy comrade may address them."
The stone pulsed in his hand, and the gigantic presences Sparhawk had sensed in the Temple of Azash were there. But this time, they were in front of him, where he could see them. He fervently wished that he could not, because their reality was still locked inside the Belium. Their forms were suffused with an azure glow. They bulked enormous before him, their brutish faces enraged, and their fury held in check only by the power of Belium.
"All right, Uloth," Sparhawk said. "This is a dangerous situation. Try to be very, very convincing."
The big Genidian knight swallowed hard and stepped forward.
"I am Uloth from Thalesia," he said in Trollish. "I speak for Annika, Belium's child. I bring word of your children. Will you hear me?"
"Speak, Uloth from Thalesia."
Sparhawk judged from the crackling roar mingled in the enormous voice that it was Quaj, the troll god of fire, who spoke. Uloth's face took on an expression of mild reproach.
"We are baffled by what you have done," he told them. "Why have you given your children to Sirgon?"
"What?"
Quaj roared.
"It was our thought that you wished it so," Uloth said, feigning surprise.
"Did you not command your children to leave their home range and to walk for many sleeps across the ice which never melts to this alien place?"
Quaj howled, beating at the ground with his ape-like fists, raising a cloud of dust and smoke from the ground.
"When did this come to pass?"
Another voice, a voice filled with a kind of gross slobbering, demanded.
"Two full turns of the seasons, Ganam,"
Uloth answered the question of the god of Eat.
"It was our thought that you knew. Blue Rose called you forth that we might ask you why you have done this. Our gods wish to know why you have broken the compact."
"Compact?"
Stragan asked after Sophronia had translated. "It's an agreement," Food explained. "We didn't really want to exterminate the trolls, so we told the troll gods that we'd leave their children alone if they'd stay in the Thalesian Mountains."
"When did this happen?"
25,000 years ago, or so."
Stragan swallowed hard.
Why are your children obeying Sirgon if you did not command it?
Uloth asked. One of the gigantic figures stretched out an abnormally long arm, and the huge hand plunged into a kind of emptiness, vanishing as it went in, almost as a stick seems to vanish when poked into a forest pool. When the hand reemerged, it held a struggling troll. The enormous god spoke, harshly demanding. The language was clearly trollish, snarling and roaring.
Now that's interesting,
Uloth murmured.
It appears that even trollish has changed over the years.
What's he saying? Sparhawk asked.
I can't entirely make it out, Uloth replied. It's so archaic that I can't understand most of the words. Zoka's demanding some answers, though.
Zoka?
The god of mating.
Uloth listened intently.
The troll's confused, he reported. He says that they all thought they were obeying their gods. Sirgon's disguise must have been nearly perfect. The trolls are very close to their gods, and they'd probably recognize any ordinary attempt to deceive them.
Zoka roared, and hurled the shrieking troll back into emptiness.
Anika!
Another of the vast gods bellowed. Which one is that? Sparhawk muttered.
Gworg, Uloth replied quietly. The god of kill. Be a little careful with him. He's very short-tempered.
Yes, Gworg, Sparhawk responded to that vast brute.
Release us from your father's grip. Let us go. We must reclaim our children.
There was blood dripping from the fangs of the god of kill. Sparhawk didn't want to think about whose blood it might be.
Let me, Uloth murmured.
He raised his voice.
That is beyond Annika's power, Gworg, he replied. The spell which imprisoned you was of Gwereg's making. It is a trollish spell, and Annika is untaught in such. We will teach him the spell.
No,
Flute suddenly broke in, throwing aside her pretense of merely observing.
These are my children. I will not permit you to contaminate them with trollish spells.
We beg you, child goddess, set us free. Our children stray from us.
My family will never agree. Your children look upon our children as food. If Annika frees you, your children will devour ours. It cannot be.
Gnom!
Quad roared.
Give her surety!
The huge face of the god of Eat twisted in agony.
I cannot.
It was almost a wail.
It would lessen me. Our children must eat. All that lives must be food. Our children are lost unless you agree.
The grass around the feet of the god of fire began to smoke.
I think I see a toehold here,
Uloth said in Alenic. He spoke again in Trollish.
There is justice in Gnom's words, he told the gods. Why should he alone lessen himself? Each must also accept lessening. Gnom will not accept less.
It speaks truly,
Gnom howled.
I will not be lessened unless all are lessened.
The four other troll gods squirmed, their faces reflecting the same agony that had marked Gnom's.
What will satisfy you?
It was the voice of the god who had not yet spoken. There were blizzards in that voice.
The god of ice,
Uloth identified the speaker.
Shlee.
Lessen yourselves,
Gnom demanded stubbornly.
I will not, if you will not.
Trolls, Aphriel sighed, rolling her eyes. Will you accept my mediation in this?
She demanded of the monstrous deities.
We will hear your words, Aphriel,
Gworg replied dubiously.
Our purposes are the same,
the child goddess began. Sparhawk groaned.
What's wrong?
Uloth asked quickly.
She's going to make a speech, now of all times.
Shut up, Sparhawk, the child goddess snapped. I know what I'm doing.
She turned to face the troll gods again.
Sirgon deceived your children, she began. He brought them across the ice which never melts to this place to make war on my children. Sirgon must be punished.
The troll gods roared their agreement.
Will you join with me and my family to cause hurt to Sirgon for what he has done?
We will cause hurt to him by ourselves, Afriel,
Gorg snarled.
And how many of your children will die if you do? My children can pursue the children of Sirgon into the lands of the sun, where your children die. Should we not join them, that Sirgon will suffer more?
There is wisdom in her words, Shlee said to his fellows.
The breath of the god of ice steamed in the air, though the air was not really cold, and glittering snowflakes appeared out of nowhere to settle on his massive shoulders.
Gnom must agree that your children will no longer eat mine, Afriel bored in. If he does not, Annika will not free you from his father's grip.
Gnom groaned.
Gnom must do this, she insisted. If he does not, I will not permit Annika to free you, and Sirgon will keep your children. Gnom will not agree to this if each of you will not accept equal lessening. Gorg, you must no longer drive your children to kill mine.
Gorg raised both huge arms and howled.
Quaj, she continued inexorably, you must curb the fires which rage through the forests of Thalesia each year when the sun returns to the lands of the north.
Quaj stifled a sob.
Shlee,
Afriel barked,
you must hold back the rivers of ice which crawl down the sides of the mountains. Let them melt when they reach the valleys.
No!
Shlee wailed.
Then you have lost all your children. Hold back the ice, or you will weep alone in the wastes of the north. Zoka, no more than 2 offspring can issue from each she-troll.
Never!
Zoka bellowed.
My children must mate!
Your children are now Sirgon's. Will you aid Sirgon's increase?
She paused, her eyes narrowing.
One last agreement I will have from you all, or I will not let Annika free you.
What is your demand, Afriel?
Shlee asked in his ice-choked voice.
Your children are immortal. Mine are not. Your children must also die, each in an appointed time.
They exploded in an absolute rage.
Return them to their prison, Annika, Afriel said. They will not agree. The bargaining is done.
She said it in trollish, so it was obviously intended for the benefit of the raging troll gods.
Wait!
Quaj shouted.
Wait!
Well?
She said.
Let us go apart from you, that we may consider this monstrous demand.
Do not be long, she said to them. I have little patience.
The 5 vast beings withdrew further into the pasture.
Weren't you pushing them a little far? Sophronia suggested. That last demand of yours may very well kill any chance of reaching an agreement. I don't think so, Afriel replied. The troll gods can't think that far into the future. They live for now, and right now the most important thing for them is taking their trolls back from Sirgon.
She sighed.
The last demand is the most important, really. Humans and trolls can't live in the same world. One or the other has to leave. I'd rather that it was the trolls, wouldn't you? You're very cruel, Afriel. You're forcing the troll gods to assist in the extermination of their own worshippers. The trolls are doomed anyway, the child goddess sighed. There are just too many humans in the world. If the trolls suddenly become mortal, they'll just slip away peacefully. If you humans have to kill them all, half your number will die with them. I'm just as moral as the rest of the gods. I love my children, and I don't want half of them killed and eaten in the mountains of Thalesia, in some war to the death with the trolls.
Sparhawk, Stragan said. Didn't Quaj do something that made it possible for you to watch Martell and listen to him talking when we were going across Pelosia toward Zemok?
Sparhawk nodded.
Can Afriel do that?
I might hear, Stragan, Flute told him. Why don't you ask me?
We haven't really been properly introduced yet, Divine One, he said with a fluid bow. Can you? Reach out and talk with somebody on the other side of the world, I mean?
I don't like to do it that way, she replied. I want to be close to someone when I talk to him. My goddess places great importance on touching, Stragan,
Sophronia explained.
Oh, I see. All right, then. When the troll gods come back,
and if they agree to our preposterous demands. I'd like to have Sparhawk or Uloth ask Quadge to do me a favor. I need to talk to Platymi back in Samora.
They do return,
Zenisha advised. They all turned to face the monstrous beings coming back across the autumn-browned pasture.
You have left us no choice, Afriel,
Quadge said in a broken voice.
We must accept your brutal demands. We must save our children from Sirgon.
You will no longer kill and eat my children?
She pressed.
We will not.
You will no longer burn the forests of Felicia?
Quadge groaned and nodded.
You will no longer fill the valleys with glaciers?
Shli sobbed his agreement.
You will no longer breed your trolls like rabbits?
Zoka wailed.
Your children will grow old and die, as do all other creatures?
Quadge buried his face in his hands.
Yes,
he wept.
Then we will join with you and do war upon Sirgon. You will return to Belium's heart for now. Annika will carry you to the place where your children languish in thrall to Sirgon. There will he release you, and there will you rest your children from Sirgon's vile grasp, and there we will join together to cause hurt to Sirgon. We will make his pain like the pain of Azash.
Yes,
the troll gods howled their agreement in unison.
Done,
Afriel declared in a ringing voice.
One boon more, Quadge, in demonstration of our newly formed alliance. This child of mine would speak with one known as Platymi in Samura, in far-off Alenia. Make it so that he can.
I will, Afriel.
Quadge held out his vast hand, and a sheet of unwavering fire dripped from his fingertips. Behind the fire, there lay a bedchamber with a vast, snoring bulk sprawled on an oversized bed.
Wake up, Platymi,
Stragan said crisply.
Fire!
Platymi shrieked, struggling into a sitting position.
Oh, be quiet,
Stragan snapped.
There isn't any fire. This is magic.
Stragan? Is that you? Where are you?
I'm behind the fire. You probably can't see me.
Are you learning magic now?
Just dabbling, Stragan lied modestly. Now listen carefully. I don't know how long the spell will last. Get in touch with Arnag in Khadach. Ask him to kill Count Garrick. I don't have time to explain. It's important, Platymi. It's part of something we're doing here in Tamale.
Garrick?
Platymi said dubiously.
That's going to be expensive, Stragan.
Get the money from Lenda. Tell him that Aelana authorized it.
Did she?
Well, she would if she knew about it. I'll get her approval next time I talk with her. Now this is the most important part. Garrick has to be killed exactly 15 days from now. Not 14, not 16. The time's very important.
All right, I'll see to it. Tell Aelana that Garrick will die in exactly 15 days. Was there anything else? That magic fire of yours is making me very nervous.
See if you can identify anybody else Garrick has been dealing with, and kill them as well. Those Pelosian barons who've allied themselves with him, certainly, and any people in the other kingdoms who are in this with him. You know the kind I mean. The ones like the Earl of Belton.
You want them all killed at that same time?
As close as you can. Garrick is the really important one, though.
Stragan pursed his lips.
While you're at it, you'd probably better kill Eivind Wargensen as well, just to be on the safe side.
He's as good as dead, Stragan.
You're a good friend, Platymi.
Friend, my foot. You'll pay the usual fees, Stragan.
Stragan sighed.
All right,
he said mournfully.
How deeply are you attached to your Aline god, Stragan?
Afriel asked as they rode back to Mytherion.
I'm an agnostic, divine one. Would you like to examine that last sentence for logical consistency, Stragan?
Vanyan asked with an amused expression.
Consistency's the mark of a little mind, my lord,
Stragan replied loftily.
Why do you ask, Afriel?
You don't really belong to any god, then, do you?
No, not really.
Sophronia started to say something, but Ephriel raised one little hand to cut her off.
You might want to look into the advantages of coming to serve me, the child goddess suggested. I can do all sorts of wonderful things for you. You're not supposed to do this, Ephriel, Sophronia protested. Hush, Sophronia. This is between Stragan and me. I think that maybe it's time for me to broaden my horizons. Styrix are very, very nice, but sometimes Aline's are more fun. Besides, Stragan and I are both thieves. We've got a lot in common.
She grinned at the blonde man.
Think it over, my lord. I'm not at all difficult to serve. A few kisses and a bouquet of flowers now and then, and I'm perfectly happy.
She's lying to you, Sparhawk warned. Enlisting in the service of Ephriel is volunteering for the profoundest slavery you could possibly imagine.
Well, the child goddess said deprecatingly, I suppose it is when you get right down to it. But as long as we're all having fun, what difference does it make?
Chapter 26 It was quite early, several hours before dawn, Sparhawk judged, when Mirtai entered the royal bedroom, as usual, without knocking.
You'd better get up, the golden giantess announced.
Sparhawk sat up. What's the problem? He asked.
There's a fleet of boats coming toward the city, she replied. Either that or the Delphi have learned how to walk on water. There are enough lanterns on the eastern horizon to light up a small city. Put your clothes on, Sparhawk. I'll go wake the others.
She turned abruptly and left the room.
I wish she'd learned to knock, Sparhawk muttered, throwing off the covers.
You're the one who's supposed to make sure the doors are locked, Elana reminded him. Do you think it might be trouble?
I don't know. Did Sarabian say anything about expecting a fleet?
He didn't mention it to me,
she replied, also rising from their bed.
I'd better go have a look.
He picked up his cloak.
There's no need for you to go outside, dear, he told her. It's chilly up on the parapet.
No, I want to see for myself.
They went out of the bedroom. Princess Danae came out of her room in her nightdress, rubbing her eyes with one hand and dragging Rollo behind her. Neatly, she went to Sparhawk, and he picked her up without even thinking. The three of them went into the hallway and up the stairs toward the top of the tower. Calton and Sarabian were standing on the east side of the tower, looking out across the battlements at the lights strung across the eastern horizon.
Any idea of who they might be? Sparhawk asked, as he and his family joined them. Not a clue, Calton replied.
Could it be the Tamil Navy? Elana asked the Emperor.
It could be, I suppose, he replied. But if it is, they're not responding to any orders I sent.
Sparhawk stepped back a few paces.
Who do the ships belong to? He murmured to his daughter.
I ain't a-tellin', Dorlan, she replied with a little smirk.
Stop that. I want to know who's coming.
You'll find out.
She squinted toward the lights on the horizons.
In a couple of hours, I'd imagine.
I want to know who they are, he insisted.
Yes, I can see that. But wanting isn't getting, Father, and I ain't a-gonna tell you.
Oh, God, he groaned.
Yes,
she responded innocently.
Was there something?
The dawn came up rusty that morning. There was no hint of a breeze, and the smoke from the chimneys of fire-domed Matherian hung motionless in the air, blurring the light from the east. Sparhawk and the other knights roused the Aton garrison, put on their armor, and rode down to the harbor. The approaching ships were clearly of Camorrian construction, but banks of oars had been added along their sides.
Somebody was in a hurry to get here,
Olaf noted.
A Camorrian ship with a good following wind can make 30 leagues a day. If you added oars to that, you could increase it to 50.
How many ships are there?
Calton asked, squinting at the approaching fleet.
I make it close to 100,
the big Felician replied.
You could carry a lot of men on 100 ships, Sarabian said.
Enough to make me nervous, Your Majesty, Vanyan agreed.
Then, as the ships entered the harbor, the red and gold standards of the church were run up on the masts, and as the lead vessel came closer, Sparhawk could make out 2 familiar figures standing in the bow.
The one man had broad shoulders and a massive chest. His round face was split with a delighted grin. The other was short and very stout. He was also grinning.
"What kept you?"
Ulaf shouted across the intervening water.
"Class distinctions," Tinian shouted back. "Knights are defined as gentlemen, and they objected to being pressed into service as oarsmen."
"You've got knights manning the oars?"
Vanyan called incredulously.
"It's a part of the new physical conditioning program, Lord Vanyan," Patriarch Emban shouted. "Archprelate Dolmont noticed that the soldiers of God were getting flabby. They're much more fit now than they were when we left Serenium."
The ship approached the wharf carefully, and the seamen threw the mooring hawsers to the knights ashore. Tinian leapt across. Emban gave him a disgusted look and waddled back amidships to wait for the sailors to extend the gangway.
"How's the shoulder?"
Ulaf asked the broad-faced Dieran.
"Much better," Tinian replied. "It aches when the weather's damp, though."
He saluted Vanyan.
"Comier, Darylen, and Abriel are leading the church knights east from Kyrellos, my lord," he reported. "Patriarch Bergston's with them. Patriarch Emban and I came on ahead by ship, obviously. We thought a few more knights here in Mytherian might be useful."
"Indeed they will, Sir Tinian. How many do you have with you?"
5,000, my lord."
"That's impossible, Tinian. There's no way you could crowd that many men and horses on 100 ships."
"Yes, my lord," Tinian replied mildly. "We noticed that ourselves almost immediately. The knights were terribly disappointed when they found out that we weren't going to let them bring their horses with them."
"Tinian," Carlton objected, "they have to have horses. A knight without his horse is meaningless."
"There are already horses here, Carlton. Why bring more?"
"Tommel horses aren't trained."
"Then we'll just have to train them, won't we? I had 100 ships. I could have brought 1,500 knights along with their horses, or 5,000 without the horses. Call the extra 3,500 a gift."
"How were you able to make them row?" Ulaf asked.
"We used whips." Tinian shrugged. "There's a Captain Sore guy who plies the inner sea, and the oars were his idea."
"Good old Sore guy," Sparhawk laughed.
"You know him?"
"Quite well, actually."
"You'll be able to renew your friendship. His ship's out there with the fleet. We'd have sailed aboard his ship, but Patriarch Emban didn't like the looks of it. It's all patched and rickety."
"It's old. I think Sore Guy has a secret bet with himself about which of them falls apart first, him or his ship."
"His mind's still sharp, though. When we asked him how to get more speed out of the ships, he suggested adding oars. It's very seldom done that way because of the expense of paying the oarsmen, not to mention the fact that they take up room usually reserved for cargo. I decided not to bring any cargo, and church knights are sworn to poverty, so I didn't have to pay them. It worked out fairly well, actually."
They gathered in Aelana's sitting room several hours later to hear Emban and Tinian report on what was happening in Eosia.
"Orzel nearly had apoplexy when Dolmont pulled all the knights out of Rendor," Emban told them.
He leaned back in his chair with a silver tankard in his pudgy hand.
"Orzel really has his heart set on returning the Rendors to the bosom of our Holy Mother. Dolmont seemed inclined to agree with him at first, but he woke up one morning with a completely different outlook. Nobody's been able to explain his sudden change of heart." "He received a message, Emban," Sophronia smiled. "The messenger can be very impressive when he wants to be."
"Oh?" "An emergency came up, Your Grace," Vanyan explained. "Zalasta had sent word to his confederates in Eosia, and they began killing the worshippers of the child goddess Afriel. That put her life in danger as well. We spoke with one of the other younger gods, Cetrus. He agreed that the younger gods would lend Afriel some of their children, and he went to Kyrellos to ask Dolmont to offer sanctuary to Afriel's surviving worshippers. He was also going to try to persuade Dolmont to send the church knights here. Evidently, he was a bit more convincing than you and Tinian were.
Are you saying that a Styric god went into the basilica? Amban exclaimed.
He said that's what he was going to do, Sparhawk replied, shifting his daughter in his lap.
No Styric god has ever gone into the basilica. He's wrong, Princess Danae whispered into her father's ear. I've been there dozens of times.
I know, Sparhawk whispered back. Cetrus paid a formal visit, though. He thought of something. Cetrus went to Kyrellos just a short time ago, he murmured into her ear. Even with oarsmen to help, Tinian's fleet couldn't have reached Mytherian this fast. Have you been tampering again?
Would I do that?
Her eyes were wide and innocent. Yes, as a matter of fact, you probably would.
If you already knew the answer, why did you ask the question? Don't waste my time, Sparhawk. I am very busy, you know.
Things seem to be coming to a head in Lamorkand, Tinian continued his report. Count Garrick's forces have taken Vraden and Agnach in northern Lamorkand, and King Fridal's been appealing to the other monarchs for assistance.
We'll be taking care of that shortly, Sir Tinian, Stragan told him. I've been in touch with Platymy, and he's arranging fatal accidents for Garrick and the various barons who've been helping him.
The door opened, and Barrett entered with Zanisha.
What did you find out, Anaray?
Sophrenia asked intently.
This morning's sortie was quite profitable, little mother, Barrett advised her. Zelasta's friend Enak showed up at the Senescan embassy, and the Anaray was able to probe his mind. I think we've got most of the details of their plan now.
Is this the lady with a rare gift? Amban asked.
I seem to be forgetting my manners, Vanyan apologized. Anaray Zanisha? This is Sir Tinian of Deira, and Patriarch Amban of the Church of Kyrellos. Gentlemen, this is Zanisha, the Anaray of the people of Delphaeus.
Tinian and Amban bowed, their eyes curious. What have our friends at the embassy been up to, Anaray? Sarabian asked.
Though it was not pleasant to probe so vile a mind, Enak's thought did reveal much, Majesty, she replied. As we had surmised, the outcast Styrix at Varel have long known that the greatest threat to their design would come from Eosia. They wished Annika to come to Tamale, but they did not wish for him to bring 100,000 church knights with him. The turmoil in western Tamale is intended to block the passage of the knights. All else is extraneous. Moreover, the attacks of the trolls in Aton are also designed to divert attention. It is from the south that our enemies plan their main assault. Even now do Senescan troops filter across the unguarded frontier to join with Scarpa's forces in the jungles of Arjuna. And Deline's from western Tamale, moreover, to journey by ship to southern Arjuna to add their weight to Scarpa's growing horde. The distractions in the west and in Aton were to drain away imperial might, thus opening a path for Scarpa to strike directly across Tamil and to lay siege to Mytherian itself. Enak and the others were much chagrined by the exposure of Zelasta's treachery, for it voided his opportunity to do us harm by misdirection and false counsel.
What's the real goal of a siege of Mytherian, Lady Zanisha?
Amban asked shrewdly.
It's a nice enough city, but...
He spread his hands.
Our enemies thought to compel the imperial government to surrender up Annika by posing a threat to Mytherian itself, Your Grace. The subversion of diverse officials gave them hope that the Prime Minister might be persuaded to capitulate so that Mytherian might be spared.
That might have worked, Sarabian noted. Pandia Subot's backbone isn't really very rigid. Zelasta and his four friends planned things quite well.
Three friends now, Your Majesty, Barrett grinned.
The NRA tells me that the one named Pataga came a cropper a few days ago.
The vampire razor? Carlton said. What happened to him?
May I tell them, NRA? Barrett asked politely.
An it please thee, Sir Knight.
It seems that Pataga was in southern Tamil proper, in those mountains between Sarna and Samar. He was waving his arms and creating the illusion of shining ones to turn loose on the populace. One of the real Delphae was out scouting the area and came across him and quietly joined the crowd of illusions. Barrett grinned a nasty little grin.
Well, Carlton said impatiently, what happened?
Pataga was inspecting his illusions, and when he came to the real shining one, not even he could tell the difference. The Delphic scout reached out and touched him. Pataga's cast his last illusion, I guess. He was in the process of dissolving when the scout left the area.
Enoch of Lidros is most discomfited by his associate's demise,
Zanisha added.
For without the illusion of Pataga, our enemies must produce real forces to confront us.
And that brings us to something we should consider, Oscania observed. The arrival of Sir Tinian and Patriarch Emban with 5,000 knights, the elimination of these illusions that were terrorizing the populace, and our knowledge of this planned attack from the south, changed the whole strategic situation.
It certainly does, Sarabian agreed.
I think we might want to consider these new developments in our planning, then, Your Majesty.
You're right, of course, Oscania.
Sarabian squinted at Sparhawk. Could we prevail on you to go up to Etana and bring Betwana back here, old boy? He asked. If we're going to discuss changes in planning, she should be present. Betwana's bigger than I am, and I definitely don't want to insult her by leaving her out of our discussions. Betwana, the Queen of the Etans, ruled more or less by default. King Andril, her husband, was a stupendous warrior, and that may have been a part of the problem. He was so stupendous that the normal concerns of the military commanders, such problems as being grossly outnumbered, for example, were quite beyond his grasp. Men who are sublimely convinced of their own invincibility seldom make good generals. Betwana, on the other hand, was a good general, quite possibly one of the best in the world. And the peculiar Etan society, which totally ignored any distinctions between the sexes, gave her talents the fullest opportunity to flower. Far from resenting his wife's superiority, Andril was inordinately proud of her. Sparhawk rather suspected that Betwana might have preferred it otherwise, but she was a realist. She had, moreover, a disconcerting level of trust. Sparhawk had carefully marshaled a number of explanations both about the need for the Council of War and about their mode of travel, but those explanations proved totally unnecessary.
All right, she replied calmly when he told her that Belium would transport them instantly to Mytherian.
You don't want any details, Your Majesty?
He was more than a little surprised.
Why waste time explaining something I wouldn't understand anyway, Sparhawk Knight? She shrugged. I'll accept your word that the jewel can take us to Mytherian. You don't have any reason to lie to me about it. Give me a few moments to tell Andril that I'm going, and to change clothes. Sarabian Emperor finds my work clothes a trifle unsettling.
She glanced down at her armor.
He's changed quite a bit, Your Majesty.
So Norcan tells me. I'm curious to find out just how much your wife has modified him. I'll be right back.
She strode from the room.
You get used to that, Sparhawk, Khalad said. She's very direct, and she doesn't waste time asking questions about things she doesn't need to know about. It's quite refreshing, actually.
Be nice, Sparhawk said mildly.
Ambassador Norcan was nervous. But both Kring and Engessa were quite nearly as calm as the Queen.
God! Emperor Sarabian exclaimed as the momentary blur faded and the trees of the Etan vanished to be replaced by the familiar blue carpeting, breeze-touched drapes, and the gleaming opalescent walls of the royal sitting room in Aelana's castle.
Isn't there some way you can announce that you're coming, Sparhawk?
I don't think so, Your Majesty, Sparhawk replied.
Having a group of people pop out of nowhere is very unnerving, you know. He frowned. What would have happened if I'd been standing in the same spot you just appeared in? Would we have gotten sort of combined? All mixed together into one person?
I don't really know, Your Majesty. Tell him that it is impossible, Annika.
Venian spoke with the voice of Velium.
I would not make such errors, and it is unusual for two things to be in the same place at once.
Unusual? Saravian demanded. Do you mean that it can happen?
I pray thee, Annika, ask him not to pursue this question. The answers will greatly disturb him.
You're looking fit, Sarabian Emperor, Betwana said. You are much changed. Do you know how to use that sword?
The rapier? Oh, yes, Betwana. Actually, I'm quite proficient.
The weapon is light for my taste, but each of us must select such arms as suit him best. Sparhawk Knight and Vanyan Preceptor tell me that much has changed. Let us consider those changes and adjust our plans to fit them. She looked at Aelana and smiled. You look well, Sister Queen, she said. Mithurin suits you.
And you're as lovely as ever, dear sister, Aelana replied warmly. The gown is breathtaking.
Do you really like it?
Betwana turned almost girlishly to show off her deep blue Aton gown that left one golden shoulder bare and was girdled at the hips with a golden chain. It's absolutely stunning, Betwana. Blue is definitely your color. Betwana glowed at the compliment.
Now then, Sarabian, she said, all business again. What's happened, and what are we going to do about it?
I do not find that amusing, Sarabian Emperor, Betwana declared angrily. I didn't say it to amuse you, Betwana. I felt much the same way when they told me. I've sent for the lady. You're probably going to have to see for yourself.
Do you take me for some child, to be frightened by stories of ghosts and hobgoblins?
Of course not, but I assure you, Zanisha really is Adelphi.
Does she glow?
Only when it suits her. She's been suppressing the light, for the sake of our peace of mind, and she's altered her coloration. She looks like an ordinary Tamil, but believe me, she's far from ordinary.
I think you've lost your mind, Sarabian Emperor.
You'll see, Dorlan. She gave him a startled look. Local joke. He shrugged. The door opened, and Zanisha, Danae, and Sophrenia entered. Princess Danae, her face artfully innocent, went to Betwana's chair and held out her arms. Betwana smiled at the little girl, picked her up, and held her on her lap.
How have you been, Princess? She asked in Alenic.
That's all right, Betwana, the little girl replied in Tamil. Sophrenia has taught us all to speak the language of humans. I've been a little sick, actually. But I'm all better now. It's really boring to be sick, isn't it?
I've always thought so, Danae.
I don't think I'll do it any more, then. You haven't kissed me yet.
Oh, Betwana smiled. I forgot. I'm sorry.
She quickly attended to the oversight. Sarabian straightened in his chair. Queen Betwana of Aton, I have the honor to present Anare Zanisha of Delphaeus. Would you mind showing the queen who you are, Anare?
"'An it please thee, Majesty,' Zanisha replied.
"'It's a startling experience, Your Majesty,' Emban said to the Aton Queen, folding his pudgy hands on his paunch.
"'But you get used to it.'
Zanisha looked gravely at Betwana.
"'Thy people and mine are cousins, Betwana Queen,' she said. "'Long, however, have we been separated. "'I mean thee no harm, so fear me not.'
I do not fear thee.
Betwana lapsed automatically into archaic Tamil.
Mine appearance here in Mithurin is of necessity disguised, Betwana Queen. Behold my true state.
The color drained quickly from Zanisha's hair and face, and her unearthly glow began to shine through. Danae calmly reached up to touch Betwana's face with one small hand. Sparhawk carefully concealed his smile.
I know what you're feeling, Betwana, Sophrenia said quite calmly. I'm sure you can imagine how Zanisha and I both felt about each other the first time we met. You know about the enmity between our two races, don't you?
Betwana nodded, obviously not trusting herself to speak.
I'm going to do something unnatural, Anaray, Sophronia said then. But I think Etana Betwana needs reassurance. Let's both try to control our reactions.
Then, with no hesitation or evident revulsion, she embraced the glowing woman. Sparhawk knew her very well, however, and he could see the faint ripple along her jaw. Sophronia had steeled herself, as she might have before thrusting her hand into fire. Almost timidly, Zanisha's arms slipped around Sophronia's shoulders.
"Well met, sister mine," she murmured. "Well met indeed, my sister," Sophronia replied.
"Did you notice that the world didn't come to an end, Betwana?" Elana said. "I think I did feel it quiver, though," Sarabian noted.
"We seem to be surrounded by people obsessed with their own cleverness, Zanisha," Sophronia smiled. "A failing of the young, my sister. Maturity may temper their impulse to levity."
Betwana straightened in her chair and put Danae down.
"This alliance meets with your approval, Sarabian Emperor?" she asked formally.
"It does, Betwana Queen."
"Then I shall abide by it."
She rose to her feet and went to the two sorceresses, holding out her hands. Sophronia and Zanisha took those hands, and the three stood together so for a long minute.
"Thou art brave, Betwana Queen,"
Zanisha noted.
"I am an Etan, Anaray,"
Betwana shrugged. Then she turned and gave Engesa a stern look.
"Why did you not tell me?" she demanded. "I was told not to, Betwana Queen," he replied. "Sarabian Emperor said that you would need to see Zanisha Anaray before you would believe that she is who we say she is. He also wanted to be present when you and she met. He takes delight in the astonishment of others. His is a peculiar mind."
"Engesa!" Sarabian protested.
"I am bound to speak the truth as I see it to my queen, Sarabian Emperor."
"Well, I suppose you are, but you don't have to be quite so blunt about it, do you?"
"All right, then," Vanyan summed it all up. "We start marching north with the knights, the majority of the local Aton garrisons, and the Imperial Guard. We'll make a great deal of noise, and Ikatas, Sirgon's high priest, we'll pass the word to Zalesta and Sirgon that we're on the way. That will give Stragan's murderers a free hand, because everybody will be watching us. Then, when the harvest festival's over and the bodies start to turn up, our friends out there should be a bit distracted. At that point, Sparhawk takes Belium to Northern Aton and releases the troll gods. Northern Aton becomes totally secure at that point. We reverse our line of march, pick up the bulk of the Etons, and go south to meet Scarpa. Are we all agreed so far?"
"No, we're not, Vanyan Preceptor," Betwana said firmly. "The harvest festival's still 2 weeks away, and the trolls could very well be in the streets of Etana in 2 weeks. We have to devise some means to slow their advance."
"Forts," Ulaf said. "I must be getting used to you, Ulaf," Kalton laughed. "I actually understood that one."
"So did I," Sarabian agreed. "But the trolls might just bypass any forts we build and keep marching on Etana."
"The trolls might, Your Majesty," Sparhawk disagreed. "But Sirgon won't. Sirgon's got the oldest military mind in the world, and a soldier absolutely will not leave enemy strongholds behind his lines. People who do that lose wars. If we build forts, he'll have to stop his advance to deal with them."
"And if the forts are in open fields, the trolls won't be able to hide in the forest," Bevier added. "They'll have to come across open ground, in plain view of the Paloi archers, my catapult crews, and Khalad's crossbowmen. Even if they cover the field with smoke, we'll be able to put down a goodly number of them with blind shots."
"My Etons do not like to hide behind walls," Betwana said stubbornly.
"We all have to do things we don't like sometimes, Betwana, Ilana told her.
Forts will keep your warriors alive, and dead soldiers don't serve any purpose at all.
Except to provide supper for the trolls, Talon added. There's an idea, Sparhawk. If you could train your Pandians to eat their enemies, you wouldn't need supply trains.
Do you mind? Sparhawk said acidly.
It still won't work, Betwana told them. The trolls are too closely engaged with my armies. We don't have the time to build forts.
We could build the forts a few miles behind your lines, and withdraw your troops into them once they're finished, Your Majesty, Sparhawk told her.
Have you had many dealings with trolls, Prince Sparhawk? She asked tartly. Do you have any idea how fast they run? They'll be on top of you before you can get the walls up.
They can't run anywhere if time stops, Your Majesty. We used that when we were on our way to Zemok. The troll god of Eat can put people, or trolls, into the space between 1 second and the next. We found that when we were in that space, the rest of the world didn't move at all. We'll have plenty of time to build forts.
Why don't you verify that with the Bellium before you start making predictions, Sparhawk?
Emban suggested.
Let's be sure that it's going to work before we base any strategies on it. Let's find out if Bellium has any reservations about the notion.
Bellium, as it turned out, had several.
Thy design is flawed, Annika, it responded to Sparhawk's question.
Venian's hand lifted Sophrenia's teacup and released it. The cup stopped in midair and hung there.
Take the vessel down, Annika, Venian's voice instructed.
Sparhawk took hold of the cup and immediately found that it was as immobile as a mountain. He tried as hard as he could to move it, but it simply stayed where it was.
Thou couldst not so much as move a leaf, Annika,
Bellium told him.
Thou canst easily move thyself through that frozen moment, but to move other objects would require thee to move the entire universe.
I see, Sparhawk said glumly. Then we wouldn't be able to cut down trees and build forts, would we?
Are those structures of great importance to thee? Doth some obscure custom require them?
Nay, Blue Rose, it is our intent to place obstructions in the path of the trolls, that they may not attack our friends, the Aetons.
Wouldst thou be offended were I to offer a suggestion?
Uloth looked sharply at Tinian.
Have you been talking to that poor stone in secret? He accused.
Very funny, Uloth, Tinian said sourly.
I did not understand.
Vanyan's tone was slightly chilly.
It is an ongoing discussion between the two, Blue Rose, Sparhawk explained, giving the pair a hard look. It hath reached a point so obscure now that it is incomprehensible. Gladly would I hear thy suggestion, my friend.
Is it needful to injure the trolls, Annika? If they be totally denied access to the lands of thy friends, the Aetons, must thou kill them?
Indeed, Blue Rose, we would prefer not to cause them harm. When their gods wrest them from Sirgon's dominion, shall they be our allies.
Would it offend thee, should I erect a barrier before them? A barrier beyond their ability to cross?
Not in the least. Indeed, we would be most grateful.
Let us then to Aetan, and I will make it so. I would not see any destroyed needlessly. My child will surely aid me, and between us she and I will bar the trolls from proceeding farther southward.
Thou hast a daughter too, Blue Rose?
Sparhawk was stunned.
I have millions, Annika, and each is as precious to me as thine is to thee. Let us to Aetan, then, that the bloodshed may cease.
Northern Aetan was forested, but the more rugged mountains lay to the south. The mountains of the north had been ground down by glaciers in ages past, and the land sloped gradually down to the Sea of the North, where eternal pack ice capped the globe. Sparhawk looked around quickly. Belium had responded to his unspoken request, and had brought only warriors to this northern forest. There were certain to be arguments about that later, but that could not be helped.
"Engessa Eitan?"
Vanyan's voice was crisply authoritative. An absurd notion occurred to Sparhawk. He wondered suddenly if Belium had ever commanded troops.
"Yes, Vanyan Preceptor," the big Eitan replied.
"Command thy kinsmen to withdraw 1 league's distance from the place where now they are engaged."
Engessa looked sharply at Vanyan, then realized that it was not the Pandian Preceptor who had spoken.
"That will take some time, Blue Rose," he explained. "The Eitans are engaging the trolls all across the North Cape. I will have to send messengers."
"Do thou but speak the command, Engessa Eitan. All shall hear thee. Thou hast mine assurance."
"I wouldn't argue, friend Engessa," Kring advised. "That's the jewel that stops the sun. If it says they'll all hear you, they'll all hear you. Take my word for it."
"We'll try it then."
Engessa raised his face.
"Withdraw,"
he roared in a shattering bellow.
"Fall back 1 league and regroup."
The huge voice echoed and re-echoed through the forest.
"I think you could make yourself heard from one side of the cape to the other without any help at all, Engessa Eitan,"
Calton said.
"Not quite so far, Calton Knight," Engessa replied modestly.
"Thy judgment of thy people's speed will be more precise than mine, Engessa Eitan,"
Belium told him.
"Advise me when they have reached safety. I would not have them trapped north of the wall."
"The wall?" Ulof asked.
"The barrier of which I spake."
Venyan bent and touched the ground with strangely gentle fingertips.
"It is well, Annika. We are within a few paces of the place I sought."
"I have ever had absolute faith in thine ability to find a precise spot, Blue Rose."
"Ever is perhaps an imprecise term, Annika."
A faint, ironic smile touched Vanyan's lips.
"It seemeth to me I do recall some talk of finding thyself on the surface of the moon when first we began to move from place to place."
"You did say that, Sparhawk," Calton reminded his friend. "Thou spakest of thy daughter, Blue Rose," Sparhawk said, rather quickly changing the subject. "May we be privileged to meet her?"
"Thou hast met her, Annika. Thou standest this very moment upon her verdant bosom."
Vanyan's hand fondly patted the ground.
"The earth itself?" Bevier asked incredulously.
"Is she not fair?"
There was a note of pride in the question. Then Vanyan straightened.
"Let us withdraw somewhat from this spot, Annika. What I am to do here will take place some 6 of thy miles beneath our feet, and its effects here at the surface are difficult to predict. I would not endanger thee or thy companions by mine imprecision, and there will be some disturbance here. Is it safe to proceed now, Engessa Eitan?"
Engessa nodded.
"Any Eitan who hasn't covered at least 1 league by now doesn't deserve to be called an Eitan," he replied.
They turned and walked some 100 paces to the south. Then they stopped.
"Farther, I pray thee, Annika. Yet again as far. And it would be well if thou and thy companions did lie upon the earth. The disturbance may be quite profound."
"Your friend is beginning to make me nervous, Sparhawk," Tinian confessed, as they walked another 100 paces back. "Exactly what is it planning here?"
"You know as much about it as I do, my friend."
Then they heard a deep-toned subterranean booming that seemed to rise up out of the core of the earth. The ground shuddered sharply under their feet.
"Earthquake!"
Calton shouted in alarm.
"I think that may be what you were asking about, Tinian," Ulof rumbled.
"This is not simple, Annika,"
Belium observed in an almost clinical tone.
The pressures are extreme, and must be adjusted with great delicacy to achieve the end we do desire.
The next jolt staggered them. The ground heaved and shuddered, and the dreadful, hollow booming grew louder.
It is time, Annika. The disturbance which I did mention previously is about to begin.
Begin? Bevier exclaimed. It's all I can do to stand up now.
We'd better do as we're told, Sparhawk said sharply, dropping to his knees, and then sprawling out face down on the carpet of fallen leaves. I think the next one's going to be spectacular.
The next one lasted for a full 10 minutes. Nothing with legs could have stood erect on the violently jerking and convulsing earth. Then, with a monstrous roar, the earth not 50 paces in front of them split. The land beyond that ghastly crack in the earth's shell seemed to fall away, while the shuddering ground to which they clung heaved upward, rising ponderously, rippling almost like a wind-tossed banner. Great clouds of birds, squawking in alarm, rose from the shuddering trees. Then the earthquake gradually subsided. The violence of the tremors grew less severe and less frequent, although there were a number of intermittent jolts. The awful booming sound grew fainter, echoing up through miles of rock like the memory of a nightmare. Vast clouds of dust came billowing up over the lip of the newly formed precipice.
"Now mayest thou contemplate mine handiwork, Annika,"
Belium said quite calmly, although with a certain modest pride.
"Speak truly, for I will not be offended shouldst thou find flaws. If thou dost perceive faults in what I have wrought, I will correct them."
Sparhawk decided not to trust his feet just yet. Followed closely by his friends, he crawled to the abrupt edge that had not been there 15 minutes earlier. The cliff was almost as straight as a sword cut, and it went down and down at least 1,000 feet. It stretched, moreover, as far as the eye could reach, both to the east and to the west. A huge escarpment, a vast wall, now separated the upper reaches of the North Cape from the rest of Tomalley.
"What thinkest thou?"
Belium asked, just a little anxiously.
"Will my wall deny the trolls access to the lands of thy friends? I can do more if it is thy wish."
"No, Blue Rose," Sparhawk choked. "No more, I pray thee."
"I am pleased that thou art satisfied."
"It is a splendid wall, Blue Rose."
It was a ridiculous thing to say, but Sparhawk was badly shaken. Belium did not seem to notice. Vanyan's face was suddenly creased with a shy smile at Sparhawk's stunned expression of approval.
"It is an adequate wall," it said a bit deprecatingly. "There was some urgency in our need, so I had not time enough to mold and shape it as I might have wished. But methinks it will serve. I would take it as kindness, however, that when next thou dost require modification of the earth, thou wouldst give me more extensive notice, for truly, work done in haste is never wholly satisfactory."
"I shall endeavor to remember that, Blue Rose."
Chapter 27
"It's not so bad in here, Sarabian," Mirtai was saying to the distraught Emperor. "The floor's carpeted, so most of the tiles weren't broken when they fell."
She was on her knees gathering up the small opalescent tiles as Sparhawk and the others emerged from that blurred gray emptiness. "Sparhawk," Sarabian exclaimed, recoiling in shocked surprise, "I wish you'd blow a trumpet or something before you do that."
"What happened, Your Majesty?"
Vanyan asked, staring at the littered carpet. "We had an earthquake. Now I've got an economic disaster on my hands in addition to everything else."
"You felt it here, Your Majesty?" Vanyan choked.
"It was terrible, Vanyan," Sophronia said. "It was the worst earthquake I've ever been through."
"Here?"
"You're going to make me cross if you keep saying that. Of course we felt it here. Look at the walls."
"It looks like a bad case of the pox," Calton said.
The tiles were jumping off the walls like grasshoppers, Sarabian said in a sick voice. God knows what the rest of the city looks like. This will bankrupt me.
It's over 400 leagues, Vanyan choked. 1,200 miles.
What is he talking about, Sparhawk? Elana demanded.
We were at the center of the earthquake, Sparhawk replied. It was up in northern Aton.
Did you do this to me, Sparhawk? Sarabian demanded.
Belium did, Your Majesty. The trolls won't be attacking the Aetons anymore.
Belium shook them all to pieces?
Sparhawk smiled faintly. No, Your Majesty. It put a wall across the North Cape.
Can't the trolls climb over it?
Betwana demanded.
I wouldn't think so, Your Majesty, Vanyan said. It's about 1,000 feet high, and it stretches from the Tamil Sea to that coast that lies to the northwest of Sarsos. The trolls won't be coming any farther south. Not in the next 2 weeks, anyway. And after that, it won't make any difference.
What exactly do you mean when you say wall, Vanyan? Patriarch Emban asked.
Actually, it's an escarpment, Your Grace, Vanyan explained. A huge cliff that stretches all the way across the North Cape. That's what caused the earthquake.
Won't Sirgon be able to reverse whatever Belium did?
Sophrenia asked.
Belium says no, little mother, Sparhawk replied. He isn't strong enough.
He's a god, Sparhawk.
Evidently that doesn't make any difference. What happened was just too enormous. Belium said that it shifted some things about 6 miles beneath the surface of the earth, and certain changes in the shape of that part of the continent happened all at once instead of being spread out over 1 million or so years. The changes were going to happen anyway, but Belium made them happen all at once. I gather that the escarpment will become a mountain range as it gradually breaks down. The concepts are just too vast for Sirgon to comprehend, and the pressures involved are beyond his ability to control.
What in God's name have you done, Sparhawk? Emban exclaimed. You're ripping the world apart.
Tell them not to be disquieted, Annika.
Belium spoke again in Vanyan's voice.
I would not hurt my daughter, for I do love her. She is a wayward and whimsical child at times, much given to tantrums and sweet, innocent vanity. Behold how she doth adorn herself with spring, and mantle her shoulders with the white gown of winter. The stresses and tensions which I did relieve in raising the wall had, in truth, been causing her some discomfort for the past 1,000 eons. Now is she content, and indeed doth she take some pleasure in her new adornment, for, as I say, she is a trifle vain.
Where's Kryn?
Mirtai asked suddenly.
We left him and Gessa and Khalad back at the escarpment, Sparhawk told her. Belium's excellent wall keeps the trolls from getting at us, but it also keeps us from getting at them. We have to work out some way to get the troll gods past it to steal back their trolls.
You've got Belium, Sparhawk, Strahgen said. Just jump over it.
Sparhawk shook his head.
Belium says that we'd better not. The ground's still a little touchy near the wall right now. If we jump around too much in that general vicinity, we might set off more earthquakes.
God, Sarabian cried, don't do that. You'll shake the whole continent apart.
We're trying to avoid that, Your Majesty. And Gessa, Kryng, and Khalad are working on something. If we can't go down the escarpment, we may have to use Tinian's fleet and sail around the eastern end of it.
End of Side 11. To continue, turn the cassette over.